Yeah.
All right. So we're continuing at YAL 2011. We're with the great Steve Vanosky. People know him from the work he's doing, obviously, in Erlang and REOC and distributed systems. Thanks for coming on.
Sure. Thank you.
So your talk here was interesting on the REOC core. So for people definitely in the audience who may not know what that means, can you tell us?
So REOC core is the distributed systems core of REOC KV, which is a key value data store.
Okay.
REOC search, which is a full text search of a capability of the database.
Mm-hmm.
So the core handles distributed systems aspects of what's needed in a highly available distributed system.
Excellent.
It's modeled after Amazon Dynamo.
Hmm.
So Dynamo was a paper that was published in, it's a system, but the paper was published about it in 2007.
Hmm.
And what the Amazon guys did is took approaches that had been developed over the years and kind of bundled them together in a kind of a cool way to solve a bunch of availability problems.
Mm.
And the guys at Basho kind of looked at Dynamo, the paper, and said, oh, we could build something like that. It doesn't give you a recipe for how to build it. It just kind of gives you the techniques they use. And then our developers had to take that and, make an implementation of it.
REOC is the answer. What's the question?
Well, REOC is an example of a NoSQL database, and that term NoSQL is used kind of broadly.
Mm-hmm.
The issue is that we know that relational databases solve a lot of problems, and they continue to solve a lot of problems, but not all problems fit the relational model. I know in my own background, I've rarely ever had to use a relational database for the problems I was solving. I used something more like a key value store,
okay.
Like a, say, a Berkeley DB, for example.
Hmm.
So not all problems fit the relational model. Problems like just semi-structured or unstructured data, for example, doesn't really fit very well.
Okay.
Problems like, Comcast or a cable company has a program guide.
Mm-hmm.
You can certainly jam that into a relational model. I've seen that done, but it doesn't actually fit very well. You have guides like on a Best Buy or a company like that have their websites and they're looking up orders, certain part numbers and get you to the data about that part or that component or that product or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
That fits pretty well with a key value store.
Sure.
So the NoSQL databases all have differing aspects to them. And, key value is one approach. There's Cassandra with column family store.
Mm.
There's CouchDB, which is like a document store. So they're all kind of targeting different areas. And you can't just take one and solve all problems with it. They're good for certain things, and other things are good for other things.
Sure. And so what's the benefit of, it seems like NoSQL is certainly, there's a lot of fads that happen in this industry. I'm not saying it's a fad. It's more of a du jour thing. So not too long ago it was functional, right? 5 years ago, functional is going to take over. It's the only way we're going to solve the concurrency problem, blah, blah, blah.
Yeah.
And then I've been seeing in the last couple of years this total movement towards NoSQL.
Yeah.
What is it about the unrelational database or, in some sense, the flattened tabular database that makes it so appealing?
Well, I think it's a couple things. I already explained that some data just doesn't fit the relational model.
Sure.
So that's one issue. But the other is just the scale of the systems we're dealing with today, that you can only get, if you wanted to buy a box, you can only buy one that's so big before, that's the biggest you can get. If you want to scale, a lot of times what you need to scale to is bigger than any one particular box that you can buy. You need multiple boxes.
Mm.
So, 10 years ago or a little bit more than that, the Amazons and Googles and other large systems were scaling out because that was the only way they could do it. They'd buy commodity servers, scale out, and they'd add servers and hundreds of servers. Akamai was certainly doing that.
Yep.
And so that kind of reintroduced this whole distributed systems problem into the picture. If you have a relational database, say you have like a big machine that's running that database, that's the one node, your clients connect to it, they operate on the data, okay, that's fine, as long as that machine stays up, you're good. But when you do the scale out thing, you've got hundreds or thousands of machines, and all of a sudden there's latency between them. There's failure rates go up just because you have more things that can fail, and so you have to deal with that.
Interesting. Now let's step back more in towards your expertise in the distributed systems and the sort of the programming distributed systems world, and that's what Ria Core sort of is on top of the database world. But now that we got the database stuff out of the way, in your talk it was really interesting the notion of the ring,
right?
Your computational ring. Can you tell us a little bit about that? Your architecture.
Sure. So, you think of you have a bunch of nodes. You have a cluster of nodes. And you can think about that and say, well, I want one of those nodes to be the master, and the others are going to be slaves. And that's certainly a common approach that people use. But the issue with that is if the master fails, a lot of times all you can do is go into like a read-only mode. And we wanted a system that was available, highly available for both reads and writes. So if you avoid masters, what do you do? You have to have peer-to-peer systems. So you have the cluster. They're all peers. Now you have a problem of where do I find things?
Right.
I can't just ask the master and it will know where everything is. So we use a technique called consistent hashing that was invented at Akamai. And what it does is it takes the key value. You have a key. So you take the key and you hash it, and you get a very large integer, 2 to the 160th, so 160-bit integer. And you, so you take that and you...
you need a beer, man.
Yeah, I need a beer. you build a ring of the value. So think of the value as a very large counter that can roll over back to zero, like an unsigned integer. Mm. So you can think of that as a ring. As you go around the ring, you're going up in value until you get all the way to the topmost value, and then it rolls over back to zero, and you're back at the beginning of the ring. Mm. You divide the ring into partitions, or what we call virtual nodes. So you might divide it into like 64, which is what we do by default, 64 virtual nodes. And then you assign those virtual nodes to physical nodes. So if you had, say, 4 physical nodes, you would walk the ring, and giving each virtual node a range of the ring from some value to some value. And then you assign that to a physical node. Take the next V node and assign that to the next physical node. And you just keep walking until you've assigned them all.
Okay.
And what that does is spreads the V nodes across these physical nodes so that no adjacent V nodes are on the same machine. The consistent hashing is kind of cool because if you add nodes or remove nodes from the system, physical nodes, which happens if you might want to expand capabilities in terms of scalability. You might want to scale the ring out, for example, so you want to add a bunch of nodes. It'll only perturb, certain areas of the ring. You don't have to recalculate every single thing that's been stored in the ring like you would if you used like a modulus style of hashing.
Okay.
So with that approach, it just enables, operationally, a pretty easy way of bringing nodes into the system with minor shuffling of the data.
Okay. Now, speaking of data, I mean, what's the mechanism for bringing computation to the data?
Yeah, that's a good question. I mentioned React Core earlier. It handles things like consistent hashing and handles the V nodes and where they are in the ring. It handles, the fact that you have a peer-to-peer system means that you can talk to any one of the nodes to get an answer. And if it's not the actual target node that has the data you're looking for, that node will route over to the one that does have it using consistent hashing. So it's almost like instead of having this one router, which also is a single point of failure in some systems, every node is a router, effectively. So you spread that out. So by knowing the consistent hashing and being able to find where things are, we've built a system over the top of React Core that's called React Pipe. And it's kind of modeled after the Unix pipe mentality, where it's a job feeding through a pipe, feeding data into another job, which acts on the data, feed it to another job, and so on. What we do is we'll allow people to set up these jobs, multiple jobs, kind of spread them out across the ring, and then removing functions they supply to operate on the data to where the data is.
Mm.
And the functions are written in JavaScript or in Erlang.
Interesting.
And you move that over there, and there's also a bunch of built-in functions you can call as well.
Mm.
But you move that to the move the computation to the data, and so it can be a lot more effective in terms of, instead of pulling data across the network.
Absolutely. Yeah. I mean, that's definitely an excellent model. Now, I have to ask, I mean, I know you're an Erlang guy,
yeah.
And Erlang, of course, is very good for this sort of thing. But you mentioned or JavaScript. What's that all about?
Well, I think JavaScript is such an easy language for people to use. Mm. You know, a lot of people are familiar with it. I guess the way we think about it is people tend to have a language they prefer. For some, it's Erlang. Some, you know, obviously Java or C# or, you know, whatever. But there's also, it seems like a lot of people just know JavaScript as well. And, of course, we've all seen this rise in server-side JavaScript.
Yes.
Over the past few years, and I think that's good. I had written about that maybe 7 or 8 years ago, using JavaScript in some of the middleware stuff I was doing, and I know others, even, you know, 5 years prior to that, were saying similar things in the middleware world.
Interesting.
Being able to program in JavaScript just because it's much easier to deal with instead of using, you know, C++ or Java or C#. You know, it's just less code.
Okay.
So it's also mobile. I mean, obviously, you can ship it down to the browser. So we can take JavaScript and easily move it across these nodes.
Mm.
And Erlang allows us to do that as well. So that's why we support both of those.
Interesting. Now, both of those run in a virtual machine.
Right.
And so you have to supply. What virtual machine are you using for JavaScript?
We use the SpiderMonkey.
SpiderMonkey?
Virtual machine. Yeah.
Okay.
It's kind of like having, you know, SpiderMonkey and Erlang VM kind of together.
Interesting.
They exchange data across the boundary.
Wow. Excellent. Now, I want to kind of focus on Erlang a little bit. And what is it about Erlang that makes it so appealing and actually more than appealing? But tell us about that.
Well, my background is in middleware and distributed systems going back quite a few years.
Mm.
Over 20 years. And initially, I did a lot of work in C++. I actually started with C++ in 1988, so I was a little early,
nice.
Earlier than most. And then, of course, Java came along, and we were working in Java. Mm. And we built a lot of distributed systems, my colleagues and I. And, you know, trying to solve hard distributed systems problems, writing tons of code, and measuring it, and, you know, refactoring it. And what I always found was you could build the core of the system reasonably quickly, but when it got to things like fault tolerance and failover and you know, all the hard bits, the reliability bits and the logging bits and stuff like that, it was always a pain. It was like you could get something working quickly, but to get it really production ready and hardened took more, you know, double the time it took to get to that first step.
Okay.
And sometimes you just never even got there. So I'm doing this over many years, and I found Erlang. So I started looking at it, and I kind of looked at it, said, oh, that's kind of cool, and you put it away, and then a couple months later, look at it again, and you get more details. And I started to figure out that they had built what I was trying to build over all those years. They had it all there. And every time I'd say, I wonder if it does concurrency really well. Well, yes, it does it. Fabulously, right?
Mm-hmm.
I wonder if it has reliability kind of built in, and sure enough, it's all there. It's got a whole complete model for reliability.
Excellent.
And so to build what I was trying to build previously over all those years on top of Erlang is quite simple comparatively.
Mm.
So it was kind of a happy and a sad moment when I discovered. I was happy that I finally found something that had everything I'd been trying to build, but I was sad that I'd wasted so many years trying to find it, you know,
sure.
Or build it.
Yeah, but, you know, it made me stronger, man.
Yeah, didn't kill me, so it made me stronger.
Well, you're really an expert. I've been talking with you off camera, you know, a couple of days ago. You were telling me about you're a freestyler.
Yeah,
right?
Sort of retired at this point.
Retired at this point, but that takes
freestyle.
A lot of skill. Yeah.
Yeah. It's a sport. There aren't a lot of players in the world. There's probably 400 to 500 ranked players in the world. It's grown quite a bit in Europe over the last decade and is now growing quite a bit in South America.
Interesting.
So the tournaments in Europe have just exploded, and the players over there have really caught on quickly. And, of course, you know, you still have quite a few great players in North America.
Yes.
And some in Japan as well. So it's spreading around the world. And the reason I like it is the people involved are always kind of very pleasant. And you can play with the guy who's the world champion, and he just doesn't care that you're just, you know, not the world champion.
Or, sure.
You know, you're out of his league, effectively. But just a great community, and it's probably one of the most difficult, maybe the most difficult thing I've ever done, except maybe for being a parent. I mean, physically, it's really demanding and takes a lot of hand-eye coordination, some flexibility, which is hard for the body at my age to do anymore.
But. Well, now listen, I mean, it also takes voluntary concurrency, right?
True.
I mean,
yeah, you, well, it's interesting because you never quite know what's going to happen, not only with what your playing partners are doing, what kind of throw they're going to send your way. It could be right side up, upside down, clockwise spin, counterclockwise spin. It could be coming at you fast, coming very slowly, then the wind comes into play, so it, you know, it's always changing. And then depending on what you do with the disc, you may push it a certain way that changes your, you may have decided to try to do a certain move, but you pushed it a certain way that you have to change quickly to do a different move. And of course, ultimately the idea is catching it, you know, throw and catch, just with stuff in between.
But
if you go on YouTube and search for Frisbee Freestyle, you'll find lots of video of people that are quite phenomenal at this sport.
Absolutely, and it's actually really fun to watch.
Yeah.
And it's actually, in some sense, it's kind of like Erlang. And what I mean by that, you know what I mean, because you said throw and catch.
Yeah.
Right? And Erlang's all about throwing messages and catching messages.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. Erlang is based around having lots of lightweight processes communicating by message passing. So you could think of that little message as a disc going back and forth.
Yeah, man.
Yeah, I like
cool.
that.
Maybe create a new language called Frisbee. Or freestyle.
Oh, freestyle. Yeah, that would
freestyle,
work.
Freestyle, man. Yeah. Built on Erlang, maybe, but even easier.
Yeah. Well, but that's I think Erlang is easy. I heard a comment in one of the sessions today where someone said, are they going to do anything about making Erlang easier to read? Because I go back and 6 months later I can't read my own code. And I couldn't believe that because the Erlang I've seen is very readable. It's quite simple. The functions tend to be very small. The there's very few elements in the language compared to a C++ or a Java or C# or other languages. And so it's quite simple to read. And immutability, you know, variables can't change once they're bound to a value. So you don't have to search like through the code and saying, where was this assigned? You know, you can see where it was assigned because it's only assigned once.
Interesting.
So,
and the thing that's so powerful about Erlang in the sense of concurrency, is it the fact that it's a shared nothing sort of world? Isn't that the whole goal? I mean, is there a shared state in Erlang?
Yeah. You can have shared state.
Okay, so
it's not forced on you, but there's this storage type called ETS. It's Erlang term storage is what it stands for. And it's like a process, but it's also a process that can... It's like a key value store in a way. You can send a key and a value in and store it, but you can also say the process that created this particular ETS table is the only one that can write to it. Others can read it. Or you can even say that any process in the system can read and write the table. And so you can share storage that way or share memory in effect that way. But other than that, you really can't. It's message passing only, and everything is communicated across processes, and you can have literally millions of processes in one virtual machine at the same time. The virtual machine has schedulers built in, so if you have like an 8-core system, you're going to get 8 schedulers, one for each core, each running on an operating system thread, and they're scheduling all those millions of processes onto those threads. It's really quite efficient. The team at Ericsson that works on Erlang always has access to equipment that you and I don't have access to, you know, coming from Intel and other places that, you know, when we're on the 8-core systems, they're already on the 32-core systems and making sure Erlang works on those systems efficiently.
Now, what is Erlang, I mean, is Erlang fast?
Not in the sense of, I mean, it can be quite efficient for certain systems. It's really good for server style of systems that have, you know, I/O coming in, which is like, you know, REAC is a good example. It's receiving requests over the network. It's dealing with disk I/O for storage. It's quite good for those kinds of systems. It's not necessarily really, really fast, but it's got all the reliability built in. And I think you do pay some cost for that reliability in terms of performance. It's a trade-off you have to make. For us, it's just the fact that you can write with just a few people a system that would take, in other languages, a team maybe 4 to 5 times the size, and probably a lot longer as well. So the code bases are small. The system that results is easy to analyze, easy to test, debug. So you're getting it right, and it's usually fast enough, you know.
Excellent. Yeah. And so I guess the final thing I'd like to talk to you about is that this great conference that we're at. We have the big Yao thing behind you.
Yeah.
I mean, tell us a little bit about your experience here and what you think of this.
Well, this particular conference, I tweeted the other day that some of the talks at this conference, just the regular talks, would be keynotes at other conferences. And it's very true. I've seen a number of talks from Simon Peyton Jones, you know, kind of the one of the people behind Haskell, talking about Haskell and programming languages. It was fantastic to see him. Mike Lee talking about product management, and you know, I'm not going to give it away, but you have to see this.
Yeah,
right?
Agreed.
It's unbelievable. And Damian Conway's keynote was outstanding. It may have been the best keynote I've ever seen in my entire life, and I've been going to conferences for a very long time.
Excellent.
And, but Yao has a history of coming from a conference started in Denmark in the late 90s called JAO, J-A-O-O.
Yep.
I think it originally stood for Java Applications, and OO is kind of focused in that area, but it soon became general. And that conference evolved. It's now called the GoTo Conference. QCon is another conference that derived from JAO and Yao. When we first came here in 2007 into Australia, it was still called JAO, but they changed it to Yao. So this whole conference series is great for speakers because they attract some of the best speakers, and speakers actually come to hear the other speakers, so that also helps attract really great speakers.
Absolutely.
So it's a lot of fun.
Totally, man. And Dave is... He's a great host,
Dave Thomas. He runs this whole Yao thing. There's a lot of planning behind it. And I think if I were in his position, I'd be tearing my hair out just worried about details. But he's he's having fun, and he gets it done.
Totally, man. And, of course, shout out to Lisa and Tamora.
MC.
Melissa.
Yeah. And MC.
Absolutely.
Up in Canada.
Yeah.
Running everything behind the scenes, but, you know, taking care of not only all the speakers, but all the attendees, too.
Absolutely. So, this is a great event, and I recommend everybody try to get here, especially if you're in Australia or near Australia.
Yeah,
it's definitely a great event to come to. And I hope you get back to GoTo and stuff. But great to talk to you.
Thank you. You too.
Very interesting. And REAC Core and REAC in general is definitely worth checking out and doing some investigation.
Go to basho.com.
Basho.com. Right on, man. Cheers. Right.
Thank you.